TNT Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox, lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
TNT.
You're with Jeremy Nell on today's news talk radio, TNT.
Jim Wolfe at tntradio.live is my email address. Thank you to everybody who has been emailing me thus far. I got a nice email from Ian in Australia. Place called Druin. Have I pronounced it correctly? Apparently it's in Victoria. Druin. I don't know how to pronounce that, but that's where Ian is. He says it's nowhere near Murray. Okay. So he says he's nowhere near where you are. okay. But thank you for your very kind email, Ian. And by the way, as you heard there, Murray is in the studio. He's making me sound absolutely awful today. I see Murray and myself kind of like the Pet Shop Boys. I'm that guy who makes the terrible one-liners with the gay voice. And Murray is the guy who handles all the technology and makes everything work. But speaking of which, Murray, I am a huge Pet Shop Boys fan. I think that they brought out some of the best 80s pop ever. That synth pop sound. Oh, I tell you what, I could just have an entire conversation about 80s music. It's dead. What happened to music? I don't know. I think it kind of died somewhere in the 90s. There's just no good music anymore. I mean, think about Bon Jovi and the glam rock era and the lyrics. I mean, that song Living on a Prayer, I mean, he's telling a story, right? It's a great story. Listen to the music now, you know, what Nicki Minaj, I don't even know if Nicki Minaj is still around. Maybe I'm even outdated on that. But the lyrics are just like these ridiculous, artificial, superficial one-liners that are all about just sex. That's it. There's no depth. There's no storytelling. Oh, man. But at least you listeners right now are enjoying the Pet Shop Boys, Germ and Murray. All right, let me get to my guest. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas.
Stay up to date on the latest news.
I follow the news pretty much throughout the day.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Patrick Henningsen, what happened to music?
You really want to have that conversation? I'm like you. I'm a complete Luddite. You know, I just switched off, and I've been mid 90s. I just switched off, and it's a big blur from there. There's reasons for that, but yeah, they used to fill up stadiums. You know, 100,000, no problem. Van Halen, Journey, no problem. Bon Jovi, filling up 100,000, boom, no problem. Yeah, we'll do 100 dates. Fill them up. And there's no acts that can do that anymore. It's just, they just can't. I think it's because of radio. Radio used to be the number one conduit for music. And there was a kind of a random, almost a surprise, a discovery, an excitement when it was served up randomly. And when everything became curated, when the digital world brought curation with it. And I think that takes magic out of it, takes the romance, the excitement, the wonder, the personal connection, the experience of it, the serendipity. It's gone. Absolutely gone.
It is gone. Yeah. Do you still play vinyls? I do.
I wish I did. I used to have some good vinyls, and they either got sold in garage sales when I needed cash, or they were lent out or lost, or the sound of the vinyl through the analog sound system is something else. And there's actually a science behind it. The sound waves have a different shape from digital to analog, and the analog sound waves actually are more rounded off, and so they're more pleasant to the ear, and they're actually, in terms of your body's vibrational frequency, there is a science behind it. Digital is sharp, it's razor, it's edgy, and this is why you feel the way you feel when you walk into a bar and you hear this annoying what they call R&B these days or whatever, and it grates on you, and there's a reason for that, makes people aggressive. There's a whole conversation you can have on that subject.
Well, you created a segue for me when you said the word digital. So, Patrick, let me ask you a question. If I show you my ACE2 receptor, will you show me your furin cleavage site?
You saw, you must have seen what I posted on social media today. I thought I'd make virology more accessible to the masses, you know, make it sexy so people can understand it, or, you know, make terrain theory more sexy by showing people, you know, what a Farron cleavage site actually looks like, you know. It's a, so, yeah, I mean, it's
where does one even begin?
It's reaching a farcical point right now. I think this is great. This is a great time in science right now, because they're pushing the issue of COVID still with the lab leak, the China virus, the lab leak, by pushing that as the official state conspiracy theory in the United States, and all the quote rebels and the intellectual dark web all absolutely parroting this line, almost like in lockstep with the U.S. government. The irony of that is nobody trusted the government, lied about everything about the so-called pandemic for, you know, 3 years. And all of a sudden, everyone believes the government when the government shouts lab leak, and all the neocons are in the background, you know, fist pumping and getting ready to, you know, gear up for a war on China. People are asking for reparations from the Chinese government. I mean, you can see where this is all heading. But Trump actually started this when he was president, but he was being prodded by the intelligence community. And a lot of people don't know the backstory to this, because we live in one world in the public where we absorb and consume things. But in the world of politics, they're given something called classified briefings. And these are given to politicians by the so-called intelligence community in order to make the politicians kind of act on some information, even if that information is not actually correct or true or scientific, a la WMDs in Iraq. So think of lab leak China virus as the WMD 2.0, much deeper, much more sophisticated. And so that's why Trump was shouting China virus, because he was already being goaded and worked on in 2019, more likely. This is according to the people that I've spoke to that are, you know, familiar with such matters, that they were working on Trump from 2019, maybe even before that. You know, you remember Fauci said at the beginning of his Trump's term that this next president's going to face a pandemic. So, you know, this idea was already being worked on in the deep state corridors and through federal agencies. And politicians generally are not the smartest when it comes to science and those complicated things. They're better at communicating emotional messages to people. So they just basically swallow whatever the intelligence services serving up. Look at our Congress. I mean, they're not all the brightest bulbs in the box. You know, this is why they're in politics, but we still need them. You know, we still trust them. There's a few bright ones, but so few and far in between.
What do you think happened with Trump? I remember having a conversation with Deborah Lerman from the Brownstone Institute, and she had done a series of wonderful articles on how Trump was played very, very well by the likes of Matt Pottinger and Deborah Birx. And there's a name that a lot of people simply don't know. But I mean, she came out of nowhere and was brought in essentially by the CIA.
She's not only that, she's Pentagon. You know, she's Colonel Deborah Birx. Don't forget, Colonel Deborah Birx. She was running the pandemic. She was running Operation Warp Speed, not Fauci. Fauci was there as a kind of pin cushion, human punching bag or whatever. He was just there to communicate concepts and ideas, to flip flop whenever necessary, and to, you know, be the voice of the science. Deborah Birx was running Operation Warp Speed. And now we know from the Brooke Jackson case, the Pfizer whistleblower, we know for sure this was a DOD operation. And now everyone's saying this now. It was a Pentagon-run operation. So, you know, it was a BARDA-run operation, not a HSS-run operation. So it'd be like if DARPA was running the war in, you know, Ukraine. That's what BARDA is. They're the DARPA, the HSS. So Deborah Birx was military. And so, yeah, she was running that. And they have total legal liability, immunity. Just like when the U.S. would bomb Raqqa and kill 20,000 people, the Syrians can't sue the Pentagon. It's war. And that's how the U.S. government used the DOD to do all of their pandemic, quote, countermeasures, to do the vaccine rollout under the auspices of war powers. Effectively, I'm simplifying it, but that's what it is. And so you can't sue Pfizer or anybody because they're covered by the same shield. Although Robert Burns is in working on the case right now where they have a small window of opportunity to nail Pfizer for breach of contract. And not doing what they promised is in the FDA agreement in terms of delivering a vaccine and not an experimental gene jab. But, you know, if they don't get that ruling through that judge, then, you know, that's it. Pfizer's free and clear. Fauci's free and clear. They're all free and clear. It was all legal. And this is the problem with this in retrospect. It's a very frustrating situation for a lot of people. And they're all still trying. Let's get Fauci for the gain of function research in Wuhan and EcoHealth. And these are all red herrings. But so consider EcoHealth, Fauci, gain of function in Wuhan. It's a red herring. It was set up by the United States government. You can see clearly they set it up. They set the Chinese up as a backstop for their backstory. Wuhan gain of function is the 19 Arab hijackers of the global pandemic. If you understand 9/11 and the nuance of that, that's what it is. 19 Arab hijackers, seven of which were alive after the attacks. Surprise, surprise. So they weren't as advertised by the U.S. government at 9/11. And same with Fauci and the gain of function. It's a distraction to keep people arguing like a JFK assassination cult for the next 30 or 40, 50 or 100 years. They'll never know, and there will never be consensus on whether it was zoonotic, lab leak, or no virus at all. I'm hoping the third option is going to win the day, because that's based on real science and the real scientific method.
Patrick, that's not going to happen anytime soon. I live in South Africa with the apparent HIV story, which is pretty much the heart of AIDS worldwide, and it's still going strong. And it's what, 40, 50 years down the line?
Yeah, you know how that was sold. The HIV 40, 50 years down the line, that the HIV AIDS story is crumbling so rapidly right now. And even people that would oppose, who still believe in the power of a super virus, have debunked the AIDS HIV story, like Robert F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. So I'm waiting for him to, kind of have an epiphany. But the problem with people, institutions and mainstream, figures is they have a instinctive resistance, and also an instinctive will for self-preservation and maintaining status. And there are certain things that are bridged too far. One is saying that vaccines are full stop or dangerous and don't do what they claim they do. That's one. And the other is to say that there's a problem with virology, that it itself is a pseudoscience. Academics just won't go there. Your Brett Weinsteins won't even entertain such things. And neither would the Robert Malones of the world, or certainly not the Gert Vandenbosch vaccinologists of the world. So they create their own intellectual dark web with Joe Rogan and Russell Brand. And these ideas get sort of kicked around in what's this little dissident playpen here. And that's all we've got, you know, in terms of dissident discourse, in terms of mainstream. So this stuff is just going to have to percolate through other corridors. And there's some amazing body of work by Dr. Sam Bailey, Dr. Mark Bailey, Dr. Thomas Cowan, Dr. Andy Kaufman, Steve Falconer, guys like this, Alex Zeck. There's so many. Yourself as well. Mike Wallach. Yep. So it's not an insignificant amount of work. There's some great literature and Massey's FOI, FOIA request challenges as well. Those are on record. And you can see the resistance from mainstream virology about this. They just don't want to accept that they're going to take down a whole field of study. But when you look at the history of virology, it got off to a bad start. I mean, the tobacco mosaic virus is a total fraud. Yeah. And that's one of the foundational pillars of the whole science. And it was a completely made up non-scientific experiment. So, I mean, it's plagued with problems from day one, virology. And the problem is with all the new technology, next generation genomic sequencing, PCR testing, it's given them tools just to run riot and do and say and make up and claim anything they want to at any time because they believe they've blinded the public and each other with science, because people work with this stuff, absolutely believe in it. They have no reason not to. They're like people who work in a religious institution. They will not abandon their core dogmas because of, you know, there are people who are whistleblowers during COVID who have done that and have sort of done that. I know Dolores Cahill has questioned the existence of SARS-CoV-2. Mike Eden had a little foray and then he pulled back, doesn't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. But there's others who have. And, you know, the Dr. Sam and Mark Bailey, admittedly, they were mainstream allopathic, believed in mainstream health, and they had a major Damascene conversion during the pandemic. And the work that they produced since then is just unbelievably good and helpful to people to really understand the scientific method and not just talk about science as if it's just this sacred, you know, cabal that can't be penetrated by the average pleb, but actually making it accessible to people that don't have time to undertake postgraduate work and things like that. They've stripped away all that and allowed you to be able to know how to read scientific papers, look at the methodology. But we're challenging the epistemology and the ontology as well. What is the thing that you are describing? Define it. Where does it sit in the matrix of things in the world? Can it be proven to exist? So it even goes further than epistemology. This is the argument that the Brett Weinsteins of the world, who are mainstream academics, they will not go there. Maybe they will go there later. Robert Malone's of the world are so ensconced in the military-industrial complex, they made their whole careers developing bioweapons and vaccines and working with all of these sort of fabricated constructs like the mRNA technology, what they call the platform. Where is any proof that it actually does what it says it's going to do? You know, get inside the cell and manufacture spike proteins. We're still waiting for the evidence of this. And it seems like Moderna didn't have it either. But this miracle happened. They got an emergency use authorization to launch mRNA vaccines because of the emergency pandemic. And they never had to bother to prove that the product was viable. They just basically manufactured, distributed it, and then stuck it into people's arms. What a great, fortunate, you know, development for the mRNA technology community. Wow, very lucky that COVID came around, didn't it? Otherwise, they'd be spending 10 years, 20 years proving it, and then it will get mothballed by the end because it's BS technology. It's total junk. But, yeah, you know, you won't hear Robert Malone or any of these guys say that. Instead, they're saying, I'm the inventor of mRNA and I'm an authority on this subject. And elderly people still need to get vaccinated, but it's dangerous for children. Thank you for speaking out against it. I think that's wonderful. In fact, Robert Malone is great because a lot of people probably didn't take the jab because of him. And he should be, yeah, you know, congratulated for that. That's amazing. But he's still clinging to the industry that made him his millions. So
he's playing in the Overton problem. Window.
They're all paranoid. People in mainstream positions are paranoid about the Overton window. They're scared of it. They're scared of Patrick, it. So that's the problem.
Murray's going to get angry. I've run late. I quickly have to go to an ad break. I'll be back with you shortly.
You should hear what Alan Miller is talking about.
Tony Blair, just this week with William Hague, has been again championing the idea of compulsory ID for everyone. Everyone should have ID. And he does it this time on the basis of technological development. Sometimes it's done on the basis of immigration or voting, often around convenience.
You know, this advancement of technology helps society in a lot of ways. But there's a difference between that and actually government effectively taking ownership of a lot of our rights under the auspice of digital ID and surveillance. I mean, this is something that Blair has been been talking about for decades. But we've also got form over the last 3 years through the pandemic era, where it went from sort of lockdowns and restrictions into a discussion and a rollout in certain countries with vaccine passports, which was in effect a form of digital ID. And, you know, there's forms of illiberal discrimination attached to that as well. So that became like a Trojan horse to other things that are now coming down the tracks. And it seems to me, without sort of going down sort of conspiracy routes, if it's handled in the wrong way or misused by governments, then we do face the risk of entrapment in terms of loss of freedoms and a surveillance culture.
Alan Miller and today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
TNT Radio.
Gas in America is $3.39, down from over $5 when I took office.
What? He's not like retarded, but there's something wrong with this guy.
Be a part of the conversation.
Come on, man.
TNT.
Patrick, have you noticed a trend with these propaganda wars, the war on terror, the war on viruses, the war on CO2? These are all invisible bogeymen.
Yeah, they're all invisible bogeymen. And even the ones that are visible, they're completely mischaracterized, like the Russian bogeyman. Actually, Russiagate was a non-existent, invisible, imaginary threat since 2016. So that's proven. But that invisible Russian threat that was built up by the U.S. deep state, by the media, by the British, by NATO, by the EU, that was used as the underpinning to get the public to buy into what is now a massively violent and destructive proxy war in Ukraine, you see. So it was an invisible enemy that was used to create the real war, in fact, or to at least promulgate the real war in the case of Ukraine and Russia, what's going on right now. But you hit on the war on terror, and that's also so apt right now, because we went from the war on terror was a redefining, paradigm shifting moment in terms of the world order, and always tilting towards the U.S. and the Western powers, giving them a little more power, a stay of execution, if you will, for the unipolar hegemony, which will continue. The pandemic is another perfect example of that. And so you have from 9/11, the war on terror, we still have all the security ornaments. We still have the body scanners. We still have all the paranoia. The idea that you got to take your liquid out of your bag and put it in a little plastic bag, and it can only be 100 mils because some scientist at Reading University said theoretically it's possible to make a liquid bomb from a suntan lotion and an Avion bottle. Okay, so now so we're still stuck with all this BS, even though the specter of so-called Islamic radical terror, whatever, is so far in the rearview mirror right now. So we still got all the trappings of the war on terror. So the war on bioterror. See, that's the new paradigm. That's what China virus lab leak is designed to usher in. So even if we don't get the war with China, it will still be a win for the U.S. and the European establishments if they can get the war on bioterror implemented. And so that's unlimited budgets, billions and trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. The bioweapons industry is a gravy train. It has been. It's a hangover from the Cold War. There's zero proof of any developments in the virology side of bioweapons. Most of it is completely crackpot science. Most of the projects have been mothballed. Most of them have sucked billions of U.S. taxpayer funding. So people who are in that hierarchy of this gravy train, including the people I mentioned before the break, okay, I don't even want to mention them again, but I might. But they've been feeding off this lie, which is a Cold War hangover. U.S. didn't know what the Soviets had. Soviets didn't know what the U.S. had. So they all kept developing stuff. Iraq 2003 should have been our wake-up call. It wasn't that so much that Saddam Hussein didn't have all of these weapons. It's that if he did, they're completely mostly useless anyway. And they promulgated the lie of sarin munitions in Syria by faking a couple of chemical weapons attacks in Khan-Shaykhun, Duma, and East Ghouta 3. And then many more were faked but didn't get the press coverage. But so that continues the whole mythology going there. And so the China virus, the lab leak, gain of function, there's zero development of gain of function in the virology field. There is in bacteriology. There's plenty of it, loads of applications. You can breed superbugs in that sense in bacteria, but nothing in virology. But they say, oh, but Fauci and the EcoHealth Alliance, the NIH funded this in Wuhan, and Fauci's emails and a furin cleavage site and ACE2 receptors, and everybody's got the jargon. Guess what? It's spike only protein. Proof of spike protein, spike. It's only spike. So man, AOC did that. You remember when AOC did her, her teach-in on spike? So everyone's like a science expert, a virology expert, just immediately overnight. And but it's only proof of emails. The Fauci email release was intentional. That was designed to put the lab leak and the gain of function story out there to create that backstop, that red herring, which they're now falling back on. And so it's only proof of emails. They said, but Fauci's discussing the furin cleavage site. Yeah, that's proof that he was talking virological nonsense with his colleagues, because that's what they're paid to do. So then funding to Peter Daszak, it's proof of funding. What did EcoHealth Alliance do? What did they do? What, they stuck swabs up a bat's nose in a cave in Wuhan and found what? Well, they say they found a coronavirus. Did they? Did they? Where is the proof of any sample of SARS-CoV-2 from a human tissue or sputum sample from patient zero in Wuhan that you can identify as a pathological infectious agent from that patient in a novel SARS-CoV-2 virus? Where's the evidence of it? There's nothing. The Chinese created a theoretical computer model based on the previous SARS templates on the computer to create their evidence of a SARS-CoV-2 genomic sequence, and that was derived from a PCR test of the lung sample of patient zero in Wuhan. There's nothing there. There's still no. So if there's no SARS-CoV-2 evidence, biological, like you can see this novel virus, if it doesn't exist in Wuhan, and that's where everybody copied the Chinese CDC, the laugh of this all is neocons are beating their chests right now in America. China's done this. China's done that. You took the Chinese CDC's bogus genomic sequence of SARS-CoV-2, and you didn't ask any questions. You just photocopied it and used it as your template for your PCR testing and rolling out your global pandemic, destroying your own American economy because the Chinese said so. Because the Chinese science CDC said that's what it was. You didn't check it. There was no science applied. And now they're screaming and crying about the Chinese now. It's laughable. But we have the same song and dance every time on the Fox News crowd fall for it. Every single time the mainstream media fall for it, mainstream academics, mainstream science falls for it. Every single time, nobody stops to think, what's the provenance of the claim to begin with? And is it actually sound? Or are we just going to run with the political juggernaut, with the hysteria? And that's what they did. And clearly there was an agenda to capitalize on every aspect of this, and that groundwork had been laid out years before. So this was just the opportunity to kick the whole thing into place. And if they weaponize this idea of a China virus or a gain of function, a mythical gain of function from Wuhan, and they spring a whole bio defense biosurveillance industry on the back of this, there's going to be no end to this. Everyone's going to be on the gravy train exactly like they were with the Department of Homeland Security, which is the largest funded U.S. federal agency right now. Still a total waste of money. $250 billion wasted every year. Wow. For 20 years. For what? For nothing. America survived without a DHS, fine, before September 11th. And they haven't done a damn thing other than spy on Americans and censor people, as we found through the Twitter files. And it's a lot of people just collecting a lot of money. And they say, oh, but you haven't seen the intelligence briefings. I have. I've got security clearance. There's a real threat. There's Hezbollah's trying to get across the Mexican border. And we found Qurans on the Arizona border. I mean, you hear these ridiculous stories that are circulating on Newsmax and some Fox News pundits and Duncan Hunter, the disgraced former California congressman, Republican. He was pushing this lie of the ISIS invasion over the U.S. southern border. I mean, we're arming ISIS in Syria. You know, we're creating safe zones for ISIS in Iraq and Al-Tanf and Syria. So, and these people are pushing this on the American public. And the American public are none the wiser because they just get battered with one emergency crisis to the next. Most people don't know. They just want it to stop. And they're not in a position in America, most of the public, to know what's true and what's not, because they're getting pelted either by the government or by mainstream media or by corporations or by big tech, or not getting good information because of the censorship on big tech.
Well, I have to just quickly go to the headlines, Patrick, so I'll be back with you very shortly.
I got a news flash for you.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. A top U.S. intelligence official has admitted Washington is using Ukraine to confront Russia. Turkey Air is reportedly considering tearing up a deal to buy F-16 fighter jets from the United States in favor of Russian or Chinese jets. And China's announced it's boosting its defense budget by more than 7% and has ordered the country's armed forces to boost their combat preparedness as tensions around Taiwan threaten to boil over.
Don't miss a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. Available right now to download. Keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
Yeah, you were talking a moment ago about the Twitter files. Patrick, what do you make of Elon?
I don't know what to make of Elon. He's like the Howard Hughes of our generation, but he's more involved in a lot more things, and I think he's got at least some I would say core values that I can recognize as things that I share and people that I know and work with share. Other words, he's not afraid of dialogue. This is a good start. As you know, the U.S. Constitution is a great document, but it's worthless without the First Amendment, because if you don't have the First Amendment, you don't have anything else after that. So, and the second's to back up the first. I don't want to get into the Constitution. But so he seems to share, he seems to value those things. So I think that's great. He's a great entrepreneur. He's a talented business person. He's a good operations person. He doesn't pretend to be an expert on everything, although he's probably proficient on a lot of things. But he's got huge, giant balls of steel, apparently. But he's also very much ensconced with the government in terms of SpaceX, Starlink. And so at some point in the future, Elon Musk is going to come into a collision course with the establishment if he's trying to express his own, you know, idea of universal principles and generally good things for humanity. Though some people will say that Neuralink is a transhumanist project and that's a problem and he's backing things like that. Yeah, you can have that debate. I'm sure he's open to having that debate as well. That's the main thing. As long as Elon Musk is open to having those debates, I don't see all of these things as a clear and present threat to anybody. What I do see is somebody who put his money where his mouth is, and there's a lot of good people that are back on Twitter involved in the global conversation because he put his money where his mouth is. And there's not a lot of people that would ever do such a thing, especially in that circle, in that elite circle. So, you know, in that sense, he's a rarity. I'm not complaining because of him. I'm back on Twitter after being banned for 18 months for life and never to come back under the Jack Dorsey regime. which was like a spook shop, you know. So it's I'm happy to have it, be able to express my free speech and my ideas and debate about terrain and germ theory and virology to many, many thousands or millions of people.
Well, just on that, Lucy in the live chat says that the no virus crew are arch grifters. So we are arch grifters, Patrick.
Arch grifters. I know it's like that sort of, you know, the same type of person would say when you're exposing the, you know, the proxy war in Syria, you're being called a Rothschild agent or a CIA shell or something. So yeah, not really grifting, just trying to get to the truth. You know, someone said, what's your agenda? Are you being paid by Big Pharma? Robert Malone came out, the great Robert Malone came out and said, immediately shouted lab leak, you know, lab leak, China virus. And it's a China virus lab leak release or whatever he said. It's on his Twitter account. And everyone, Jay Bhattacharya from Great Barrington Declaration, he chimed in. Brett Weinstein chimed in. Glenn Greenwald chimed in. Oh, Glenn was more nuanced about it. And then, of course, Joe Rogan will sort of echo whatever those guys say, because it's then safe to say it. And then all of a sudden you have that echo chamber that's formed there. And all their followers attacked me and said, are you being paid by Big Pharma? What's your agenda? And I was like, my agenda is getting as close to the truth as I can. That's my agenda. And I'm following the scientific method. That's my agenda. That's what I was trained to do even in my master's level of political science. The hardest course I took was research methods. And I did good in that course because it was hard. I didn't understand it, but I was determined to learn and understand what was in there and what it meant. And what I'm shocked to find is there's people more qualified than me with PhDs, doctorates, who are lauded with public praise, who don't care and completely routinely discard basic methodology, observing epistemological principles, and won't even touch philosophic or ontological questions because they themselves have their own dogma. And so you can't have a conversation about the science of COVID-19 or even vaccines. Yeah. I mean, Gert van den Bosch, he's a vaccine. He worked for Bill Gates and Gavi, and he's on Rogan, or I don't know if he's on Rogan, but he was on Brett Weinstein's podcast talking about if you vaccinate during a pandemic, you'll create vaccine resistant variants, breakthrough infections. I'm just like, where does this stuff come from? And there's all these sort of internal concepts and theoretical phenomenons that are kicked around within those industries, but they're not based on any scientific observation. They're all done in the realm of theoretical observation and computer modeling. And computer models is getting this planet. It's computer models will be the bane of the human race. The whole climate agenda is driven by computer models. And the whole epidemiological hysteria of COVID was driven by Neil Ferguson and his like, and Lee Fang Dang, whatever his name was at Harvard, that crazy guy who calls himself an epidemiologist. And Drosten and all of them. I thought epidemiologist was a, you know, a high level title because I saw them in Hollywood for years. In the last couple of years, I realized what a charlatan's profession it is. Because they're basing their epidemiological models on data that's derived from PCR testing to create cases. So the data's garbage. At the point of capture, the data is garbage. So the epidemiological information and the projections are complete fantasy. So it's a worthless, I'm going to say, epidemiologists, biostatisticians, and bioethicists who can't see any of this, worthless professions. It's about as worthless as half the social science and the woke degrees that they're handing out under what they call a social justice framework. I looked at this when I was doing my master's because the teachers had all these things on offer. And I looked at it and I was like, I looked into it and I thought, okay. But then after a while you realize, oh, so you want a completely imaginary, postmodern, politicized, school framework of intellectual knowledge. No, I'm sorry. This is not going to work. But that level of postmodernism has crept into science And now we've got a big problem on our hands because we can't shake all these people out of the institutions. And they talk with, and they have backing and they have authority. So people in the media parrot them. And people don't know what the hell they're parroting. I didn't know what half of what I was parroting when COVID started. I was just learning the jargon, you know, because we all have to become experts overnight. And then soon after a while, you do realize that this, most of this is completely, you know, it's science fiction, basically. Mm. And it needs to be questioned and it needs to have rigorous interrogation, even if it's settled science, still needs to be interrogated. Because throughout history, settled science has often been overturned. And I think we're at one of those moments now in history and civilization. Will it get overturned? Because if it does, there's brighter days on the other side for humanity. If it doesn't, and it's allowed to hold, and the lies are allowed to be keep us in suspended animation as a society and a culture, then there's going to be more problems, and the battle will rage on for a while.
Patrick, just if you don't mind, hang on a moment. Murray, let's just quickly do my last ad break.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
The other day, I talked about how dangerous the left's obsession with sacrificing excellence for equity can be when it comes to the cockpits of our jumbo jets. We should, in fact, demand that only the best and most qualified get to pilot those planes, no matter what race they are, right? Of course. And we should also demand that the agency that oversees the airline industry, the FAA, has a leader that's top-notch. Well, don't tell that to Joe Biden. You see, he was instructed to nominate Philip A. Washington, the chief executive of Denver's airport, who, by the way, served in the Army for 24 years. The problem is he doesn't know much, as he proved at his Senate hearing last week.
What airspace requires an ADS-B transponder? Quickly, please.
Thank you for the question, Senator. Not sure I can answer that question right now.
And that's how it continued.
Sorry, Senator, I cannot answer that question. I don't want to guess on that, Senator.
Folks, this is plain embarrassing. But you see, it's okay to the left, because if approved, Washington would become the first black person confirmed as FAA administrator. God help us all. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has slammed the unprecedented infusion of private money into America's elections, calling the tactics of the Center for Technology and Civic Life, CTCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, totally unacceptable. DeSantis stated, so Zuckerberg, he spent over $400 million through these, quote, non-profits to, quote, help with election administration. But what they would do is they would require certain things to be done, like mass mail balloting, ballot harvesting, and they would focus on partisan voter turnout, basically. That was totally unacceptable. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson doubted whether Mark Zuckerberg's highly partisan 2020 election spending was even legal. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, commenting about an investigation by the Wisconsin legislature into Mark Zuckerberg's election influence, asked, did Mark Zuckerberg purchase the Wisconsin presidential election?
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Patrick, I was just thinking while you were talking, the CO2 narrative seems to be a lot more embedded now in the alternative. When I say CO2 narrative, I mean the counter CO2 narrative is a lot more embedded in the alternative independent space now. You know, there isn't as much pushback as when you say virus. There's still a huge amount of pushback, even from those who perhaps are on the edge. You know, they're standing in that plane, but they just haven't jumped out yet with the parachute. Do you think that that's going to change?
Yeah, well, those of us who jumped out of it, out of the climate plane in 2007 and 2008, we jumped out without a parachute, and we somehow made it. I think the climate thing is going to break quicker because, you know, reality, just day-to-day reality, doesn't comport with the doomsday predictions and the, you know, the rantings of St. Greta of Thunberg. So it's just not going to, it doesn't square with reality. And also, you know, the whole trick of rebranding man-made global warming into climate change made it more of an arbitrary term. So you could then add climate chaos, climate emergency, climate disaster, whatever, whereas with man man-made global warming, you had to be specific because that meant man-made CO2 driving global warming. Very hard to prove. But climate change, well, of course, the climate always changes. So it's a little bit of an NLP trick there. The problem with the virus and the germ theory obsession with people in modern life is that it becomes very personal. So it goes deep to the core. And you hear this all the time. If you're challenging the idea that there was a global pandemic and not a PCR pandemic, people will come into the comment threads on Twitter and say, but I was really sick last year, and I know it was sicker than the year before, and I lost my sense of taste and smell, and my friends were sick as too, and they said it was really bad. And so I'm like, well, you know, with all due respect, I'm sorry for your illness there, but, you know, your anecdotal story is totally irrelevant when it comes to us trying to decide or extrapolate a global pandemic. So, you know, but it's all based on emotion, and everybody has their own personal truth. And these days you hear all this, I'm standing in your truth. You stand in your truth, sister. You stand in your truth. You know, what does that mean? Standing in your truth. What exactly does that mean? What is the truth? That's the question we need to be asking. You could be standing in your truth, but be standing in a fantasy land, which I think there's now society with the kitted gloves and coddling people the way they do. I think in this kind of new sibling society that we have developed, it's almost like people are allowed to be ignorant. They're almost like you're validating. I'm validating your ignorance. That's the next one I'm waiting for from the woke brigade. I validate your ignorance, and literally, it's the emperor's new clothes at that point. So that's the problem with the germ theory, with the pandemic argument, is that it's so deep, it's so personal, it penetrates your personal life. But the other side is once the light bulb goes off, you have witnessed somebody who has suffered an adverse reaction to an experimental mandated pharmaceutical product, that's personal as well. And that's going to radically shift your view on things and going to change your constitution on it. And that will never turn. And so I think those numbers are going up, and they're not going to go down because they jab so many people that the adverse reactions, the deaths from jabs will keep going up. And so the resistance, the dissenting community will grow and eventually will crush this black mark in human history, this giant experiment. And whoever's clinging to the establishment and clinging to their academic disciplines at that point and their funding and their grant money and all of this stuff, they'll be running for the hills at some point in the future on this, or they'll be pretending like I never believed it. I never believed there's a pandemic. Okay, fine. I never believed vaccines were safe and effective. Okay, fine. Next time you better speak up about it instead of being quiet about it. So at the moment, there's a lot of good influencers that have emerged in recent years that were all shilling for lockdowns and vaccines from day one. And now they're sort of trying to pivot out of it. And I think that's wonderful. But I'm like, hey, you know, great, fashionably late, but thanks for showing up. You know, thanks for showing up. Yeah, I know you had a $10 million book deal. I know you had a $50 million television deal. You wouldn't want to jeopardize that. I mean, who would, right? Yeah. Who would? But you're an influencer. So what's the freaking point of being an influencer when you command whole demographics, but you can't bring yourself to challenge the pharmaceutical establishment or the government media, the government medical, and the government military complex? If you can't bring yourself to challenge them, in a way, that's why people in the independent sphere are liberated intellectually. The more successful you get, and the more you are aligned to bigger institutions, and the more you scale up, you run into friction on this stuff. No one's immune to it. No one's immune to it. I know people that have been in the trenches of blogosphere who have ascended to very high levels in recent years. And of course, they've adopted more mainstream sensible positions and who've moved into more respectable quarters of society rather than being in the lunatic fringe. And it's just the natural nature of things. And so this is always going to be a challenge. So we need mavericks. We need people challenging the narrative. We need people that are risk takers. The more successful you get financially in media or in politics, you take less risks. This is a fact. Mm. And so that's always going to be a problem, you know? So, you know, this network is very fortunate that it's able to, you know, freewheel and, you know, be on the Wild West, you know, plane of information warfare that it is. And there's a few other outlets like TNT. But, you know, there's always going to come up against friction on that. As soon as you reach a certain scale, that's when the establishment gets scared. And, oh, my gosh, we got to shut this down. We got to keep this one quiet. Otherwise, it's going to screw up the narrative, the consensus reality that we've invested trillions of dollars into. So, you know.
I think Nassim Taleb, okay, so he made some serious blunders in 2020, but his books are nevertheless still very good about taking risks. And often those who are outliers are the big risk takers, and they either go for broke and they get it completely right, or they get it completely wrong. So it's all about whether or not they are willing to put their integrity on the line. And as he pointed out, if you've got more to lose, you're less likely, you know, to get it wrong, because you're putting a lot more into it. That's something I've learned, Patrick, over the last few years, is who to put more faith into, more trust in. It's those who've got more to lose.
That's right. Those who've got more to lose, and those who have put it all up on who've risked it all, who put all their chips up on the poker table, which is your credibility. When you take a risk on an issue, or you take a position on something, you're putting all your chips up there. That's your personal, professional, family credibility, everything there. And so when I came out on, you know, March 17th, 2020 and said, everyone's freaking out for no reason, this is going to be an economic disaster, don't do it. And it's still pinned to the top of my Twitter account. So even though they banned me, my old tweets were still there when they brought me back, and it's still there. So I risked all my credibility back in 2020. And so when I speak on this issue now, people know that I risked it. So that increases my credibility, in the sense that I was willing to go and risk, you know, all the insults and all the smears and all the and the deplatforming and all of that. The difference between a journalist and a commentator or a comedian is that someone like, I'm not picking on Joe Rogan, I think he's a pretty great guy all around, but, you know, he says stuff on his show that he believes because he heard it on Brett Weinstein's podcast, or he heard on someone who's cool, Russell Brand's podcast, not because he's actually gone through the literature, the scientific literature, or, you know, has looked at all, got second and third opinions behind the scenes and figured the science out of what he's talking about. So he's relying solely on the credibility of his, what he believes are his, you know, circle of friends, or the intellectual dark web, as they like to call themselves, the Ben Shapiros of the world, and these, that sort of conclave. So, but a journalist will go and actually do the work to know for sure what they're saying. It's not just what you know. When you hear someone say, "We know," that's when the alarm bells should go off. And you hear a lot of this with mainstream academics. We know that PCR tests work. No, we don't know. So, but it's one thing to know something, and it's another to understand it, and be able to articulate all of the different compartments of that situation, that argument, that scientific phenomenon, and be able to, you know, refute, be able to falsify something that has been held as a sacred cow for years. And if you're not willing to do that as a pundit, then you can't call yourself a journalist, for sure. You're just a commentator. You're an entertainer. But we need more journalists. We need less entertainment. We need more journalism.
Patrick, thank you for saving me there. I think you noticed I dropped off, and that's because I had a major power outage. It's one of the problems of living on the African continent.
I lived in Lebanon for a while, and it was 6 hours a day. Diesel generators.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, you're an amateur. Diesel
car batteries. Car batteries, diesel generators. I heard in South Africa, that's like a chat up line now when you're dating. You say, have you got a generator? And they're like, we got two generators.
Do you have power?
So, oh my gosh. I feel for you guys, man.
We average 8 to 10 hours a day of no electricity every single day.
This is crazy.
But yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts. But as it turns out, we're running out of time, so I can't chat to you about that. I'm just glad that I was able to come back and you saved the day there for a few minutes. So thank you. All right, let's just quickly promo your show.
Yeah, my show on TNT, The Patrick Henningsen Show, that's 4 p.m. till 6 p.m. UK time, 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. East Coast Standard Time. Also, The Sunday Wire at 21st Century Wire every Sunday, 5 p.m. UK, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard, and The UK Column Television on Friday, 1 p.m. UK time. Great alternative media outlet, ukcolumn.org as well. So those are my three live shows, seven live shows a week. And yeah, and I'm very happy to be on your show today. I think you're doing amazing work, Jeremy. You're a trailblazer. Yeah. Although germ is in your name, you've done a lot of damage to the germ world over this last couple of years.
Thanks, Patrick. I wouldn't have said this 3 years ago, but I'm saying it now. I think you're probably one of the most inspirational journalists out there.
I appreciate that. I'll take that. Definitely. Thanks. Mm. I'll take it and bank it. Thank you.
The reason why I wouldn't have said that 3 years ago is because I don't think I was as red-pilled then as I am now. So so now I see things quite differently. But anyway, Patrick Henningsen, thank you for joining me in the trenches again.
All right. Anytime, and Jeremy.
Great stuff. And thank you to Murray for making me sound absolutely awful as always. Please send your complaints to germwarfare@tntradio.live. I'm only kidding. If it weren't for Murray, I wouldn't have a show. So we are the Pet Shop Boys. Anyway, I'm out of here. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the Battle of Ideas.